Hello, this is Grover Furr. Today I'm going to be talking to you about the two models of modern history. Now, I'd like you to refer to the web page called paradigms.html, which has as the title The Two Models of Modern History, and is on the World Wide Web. You can either consult this right on your computer as I talk, or you can print it out and use it as a handout. But in any case, I think it's helpful to look at the diagram at the top of the web page to get an idea of the how these different paradigms or models, frameworks is another way to put it, how they work, how they contradict one another. In fact, they're, they're almost the media. Almost the immediate opposites, the direct opposites of one another. The paradigm that I was raised with, and that I'm certain that you were raised with and educated in as well, is the one that I've entitled here the Cold War paradigm. First, let me say a word about the term paradigm. Paradigm is a kind of fancy word derived from the Greek, which is used in science and social science, and there are several ways to look at what it means. One is that it means a model, right? A simplified version of how a more complex reality really functions. Another and perhaps better way to conceive of it is as framework. That is to say, context in which I'm using this term here, the word paradigm is a framework around which people understand the world. In that sense, it's similar to the term ideology or ideological construct. The value of a paradigm is that it should be taken for granted. The value of a framework is that it should be the organizing principle behind which everyone thinks. You fit facts and secondary ideas into this basic framework. Now, let me illustrate that by just going over what I call the Cold War paradigm. The Cold War paradigm might well be called the imperialist paradigm, as you'll see. I use the term Cold War because it's the most immediate version. It's the version that has reigned since the Second World War, and particularly since 1946, the beginning of the so-called Cold War between the United States and Western Europe on the one hand, and the Soviet Union, later China, and the Communist world on the other hand, and 1990, which is the collapse, or the end, the transformation into something else, of Soviet communism into a different kind of capitalism. But in any case, the Cold War paradigm could be called and should be understood before World War II as the imperialist paradigm. And what does that mean? Well, here's the idea. I think you'll find these basic fundamental premises very familiar. The Western capitalist democracies, about Western Europe, the United States, and of course after World War II, Japan, but leaving Japan out, Western Europe and the United States, perhaps Canada, were said, and we were taught, I was taught, and I'm sure you were, stand for freedom, independence, democracy, civilization, morality, modernity, in the sense of modern industrialism, Christianity, and right religion. Now, all of these things are, all of these qualities are the selling points of Western capitalist democracy. They claim, the claim was, and the claim remains, that around the world, the United States and also Western European countries stand for these things. That's their claim. This claim was never really seriously questioned. It certainly wasn't when I was educated, I doubt that it was for you in any serious way. The term civilization and Christianity are more heavily stressed before the Second World War, as we'll see, but are still very important after World War II for many people. Before World War II, there really was no large-scale communist movement outside of the Soviet Union, which was a non-industrial and therefore not very important country. There wasn't a Cold War as such, but nevertheless there was a communist movement since 1917, since the Bolshevik Revolution. And the communist countries and the communist movement stood then, it was said, under the Cold War paradigm, for lack of freedom, dictatorship, barbarity and cruelty, immorality, loss of national culture, and I should have added here, atheism, perhaps. Now, this should be familiar with us, the Cold War period. This is the organizing principle, this model around which the entire Cold War in the West was organized. Now, juxtaposing to that, the anti-imperialist paradigm shows us that at least that there is a radically different way of looking at the realities of the 20th century and especially of post-World War II 20th century. I call this the anti-imperialist paradigm. It isn't exactly the communist paradigm at all, but communists played a role in the anti-imperialist movement, so that the anti-imperialist paradigm embraces those who opposed imperialism for whatever reason and by whatever means, the communist movement being a very important but far from the only force in this anti-imperialist project. In the anti-imperialist paradigm, notice that it's precisely the Western capitalist democracies who claim in the Cold War paradigm to stand for all these good things that are the imperialist, the brutal imperialist countries. They stand for lack of freedom because they have imposed their domination, imperialism, colonialism, on virtually the rest of the world. They stand for dictatorship in reality as opposed to their claims because they never permitted democracy in their colonies. In those areas of the non-Western world where they had the power to do whatever they wanted to, they chose uniformly, without exception, not to institute democracy. They stand for barbarity and cruelty. The real horrors of exploitation and murder by the imperialists are virtually never taught in Western schools. And I'm going to give you some examples of this, and we'll see other examples in some of the literature, some of the materials we'll be reading. But it's hair-raising. It came to my attention first during the Vietnam War when I began to learn about American atrocities in Vietnam and thought, wow, where did all this come from? This is something new. And then studying over the next years the history of Western imperialism, not only American imperialism, but also Western European imperialism, I discovered that there was nothing new about it at all. Immorality, well, whatever immorality is, it's certainly not these things. Loss of national culture is an attempt on the imperialist part to impose a sort of version of Western culture, cultural values, a way of saying that the values of the people who are colonized, of the victims of imperialism, is not worthwhile. So, the people who we are taught are the good guys, us, that is to say, the Western capitalist democracies, who are the good guys in the Cold War paradigm, are the bad guys in the anti-imperialist paradigm. And conversely, the people who are the bad guys in the Cold War paradigm are among the good guys in the anti-imperialist paradigm. There are others who are fighting against imperialism, but the communist movement was certainly the most effective, though far from the only force. So in the anti-imperialist paradigm, the communist countries and the communist movement stand for freedom from imperialism. In many countries in the world, the communist movement led the anti-imperialist struggle, and in almost everywhere, they at least participated in the anti-imperialist struggle. Independence. Communists stood for independence from imperialist domination. Democracy and civilization, well, of course, a form of democracy. The West never stood for this. The communists did have a form of democracy, even in those areas where they dominated. That is, a wider political participation. Didn't use the same political forms and that are used in the West and that are called democratic, a representative government in the United States. It raises the whole issue of just what really is democracy anyway. But certainly the communist countries could have as great a claim to being truly democratic as the Western imperialist countries, though quite a different kind of claim. Morality, which is made up of adhering to all of these different, all of these goals. Modernity, very important. The Soviet Union and China were the only countries on the face of the world that were able to industrialize in the 20th century independent from the control of the imperialists. No other countries entered the 20th century as non-industrialized countries and industrialized so rapidly and so successfully. And this was a great attraction in the colonized countries, the areas of the world, most of the world controlled by imperialism. It was a great attraction of communism, that it seemed to be the way for national assertion, national independence, national self-assertion. And the defense of national culture. Communism, the communist movement always made it a big emphasis that traditional cultures should be preserved as much as possible, consistent with the values of egalitarianism and modernization, and that the peoples in the formerly colonial world should not abandon their cultures, view their cultures as inferior to those of the West, and abandon their cultures, period. Now, I think it's very important to regard these as frameworks. That is to say, the same events can be interpreted in different ways depending upon which framework you think you are trained to think in, or if you're trained to think critically, and I hope that's what's going on here in this class, which framework you think is the most accurate. The Vietnam War is a very good example. And I'm going to talk about it very briefly. In the Cold War paradigm, the United States invades Vietnam in the 1960s in order to stop the communists from taking over the world. The United States claims that it's a Western capitalist democracy standing for freedom and independence, democracy, so forth and so on, and the communists are trying to impose some sort of cruel form of slavery or dictatorship. In the anti-imperialist paradigm, which is that shared by most Vietnamese, certainly, the United States was simply replacing the French as the next imperialist country to dominate Vietnam. And the communist movement led the struggle for national independence, for national self-determination, led the anti-imperialist struggle. And without understanding this, you don't understand why it was that the communist movement was so successful in mobilizing so many millions of people on its side, whereas the Vietnamese government, controlled and supported by the United States, was relatively far, far less successful. Depending on which framework you use, you will evaluate the Vietnam War differently. And the same is true around the world. There are some other points that I'd like to make here. One is, I've left it off this diagram because I can't cram everything in here. One is the issue of racism. The imperialist countries, including the Western capitalist countries, of course, stand for racism. They invented racism. They promoted racism throughout the non-white world, which really means all of the colonial world, or the vast majority of the world, which at one time they controlled. The anti-imperialist forces, including, but not confined to the communist rule, were very opposed to racism, both within the colonies and also within the Western imperialist powers as well. Within the United States, the communist movement was the strongest force against racism, within Great Britain, within Western Europe, and so forth. The question of women's rights. Similarly, the anti-imperialist, but particularly the communist movements, fought most vigorously for women's rights. And here you have, let me take one more good example. In its declining days as a society that had any claims to being communist or socialist at all, the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan in 1979. And in Soviet Afghanistan, women had full rights to education and legal equality with men. In the society created by the anti-communist rebels, the so-called Mujahideen, supported very vigorously in the billions and billions of dollars of aid by the United States and the other Western powers in the name of fighting communism, women have no rights. They're confined to the home, they have to wear the veil, they cannot work, they cannot drive cars, they're not allowed to write to education, and so forth. So that the anti-imperialist movement, the communists, including the, very importantly, the communist segment of it, stand in the 20th century for the rights of women, equality for women. Not by the way, I'm not claiming that they ever achieved full ideal equality for women, but far more than the imperialist societies did. The imperialist societies, of course, never stood for that. There were big struggles for women's rights throughout the 20th century in the imperialist societies, which were successful to a greater or lesser extent, but the societies themselves, the governments themselves, never stood for that. These were reforms that were forced by mass movements. And the communists, even in those countries, were parts of these mass movements. Now, there's a few other points I want to make, but I think I'm beginning to get the idea here. We in the traditionally imperialist countries are taught that there is only one way to understand the world. Even for the purposes of refuting other ways to look at the world, we're never introduced to the anti-imperialist framework. It's simply regarded as either it doesn't exist or it's a form of communist propaganda. The anti-imperialist paradigm is either not taught at all, usually, or taught in a seriously distorted manner as a communist line, which basically means whatever it says, don't pay attention to it. However, you should understand that the anti-imperialist framework, this paradigm, is familiar to most of the world's population. They don't see the Cold War and the world of the Western democracies in the same self-congratulating way which we're taught to do it. That is to say, what seems self-evident to someone coming out of our school systems, perhaps to us at one point, that the United States stands for freedom and democracy, is by no means clear to people around the world, let's say especially in Latin America or Vietnam, where the United States has supported unbelievably repressive dictatorships, mass murder, and so forth, throughout the 20th century. Any more than it seemed like that to the American Indians, the Native Americans in the 19th century, who were decimated, almost exterminated, by the actions of the American military. The anti-imperialist paradigm seems just as natural, even to relatively conservative writers, let's say like Chinua Achebe from Nigeria, in the Third World, in the formerly colonial world, as the Cold War paradigm may seem to us today. It's also the case that the Cold War paradigm was at one time not universally shared, even in the West, even in the United States. In Western Europe, it's never been as strong. There have always been large minorities of the population, mainly under the sway of the communist and the labor movements, who have not accepted it, or not accepted it totally. In the United States, it took the beginning of the Cold War, the so-called, what's often called the McCarthy period, but which was really a sort of general cultural and educational cracking down, starting about 1947 and going through for the next 5 or 6 years, before opposition to the Cold War framework was suppressed. There was a great deal of opposition to the Cold War framework. It's often forgotten that there were labor unions and even a member of Congress, a lot of opposition to the United States participation in the Korean War, but not from a pacifist viewpoint, but from the viewpoint that this was a cover-up for imperialism. Here comes the United States trying to take over South Korea, which of course it did. You should notice that the evaluations of these two paradigms, these two frameworks, are reversed. If you accept the Cold War imperialist way of understanding the world, it follows automatically that the West is basically good. And you can fit all the horrors that were ever carried out by any Western imperialist power as exceptions, you know, as understandable, perhaps even necessary, failings to live up to the letter of their values or ideals, because whoever, you know, who among us can ever be perfect? But nevertheless, failings in an otherwise noble goal. According to the Cold War paradigm, no matter what horrors the imperialists, the capitalist democracies of the West are guilty of, no matter what horrors they commit, these are always deviations from an otherwise completely admirable and wonderful goal. On the other hand, if you accept the anti-imperialist framework as a closer understanding of reality, description of reality, then the horrors committed by the imperialists are completely understandable. They flow from the exploitative and brutal goal of imperialism. So, according to the anti-imperialist framework, the imperialists, of course, naturally describe their own motives as very noble. But they're not. If you accept the anti-imperialist paradigm or framework, it follows that the actions of the Western countries are basically exploitative. Or at least those of the rulers of the imperialist countries, those who really benefited from imperialism, those are the people who are basically bad. And so a word about class is important here, social class. The anti-imperialist framework, not only the communist version of it, but other versions as well, not all, but most, recognize that there's a big difference between the rulers, the real imperialists in the Western imperialist countries, and the masses in those countries. Let me give you an example. Mohandas Gandhi, you know, one of the founders of modern India, traveled in the early 1920s to Great Britain on behalf of the textile workers of India, who were being tremendously exploited and, of course, brutally beaten down by the British. British textile companies had built their most modern factories with the most modern machinery in India because the labor was so cheap they could make more money that way. As a result of this, the textile industry in Great Britain was outdated, outmoded, laying people off, doing very poorly, and the British textile workers were severely harmed by this outflow of capital away from England towards India. They were losing their jobs. Very similar process going on in the United States today in the last 20 years, right? American investment going abroad where labor is cheap and jobs being lost at home. Same thing in the 1920s in England. Gandhi went to make a speaking tour to labor union organizations and was very concerned, since he knew very well that a lot of the British working class were very racist, very concerned that he might get a hostile greeting, that the British workers might view Indian workers as taking away their jobs. Well, what happened was exactly the opposite of that. He actually was greeted very enthusiastically. The trade union movements in England, at least among the textile workers, had successfully convinced many or most of their members that it was not the Indian, incredibly underpaid and brutally treated and exploited Indian textile workers who were taking away their jobs, but it was the capitalists. It was the owners of the textile mills. And that if Indian textile workers got higher wages, to the extent that they did get higher wages and labor became more expensive in India, there'd be less incentive for the British textile mill owners, to invest abroad. They might actually start investing in England again. So he actually was greeted enthusiastically in his speaking trip in the early 1920s in England. This illustrates that not only did Gandhi understand that the working men of England were not his enemies, the enemies of the Indian textile workers, but the working men of England understood that the Indian textile workers were not their enemies. That is to say, there were some beginnings here of international solidarity. Both understood that the real culprits here were not the masses, but the ruling classes, the wealthy, the exploiters, the capitalists. These are the people who benefit from imperialism. On the other hand, the imperialists do a good job of disguising imperialism as being in the interest of the people in the imperialist countries, and there's always a significant number of people who believe this. So there are people in the imperialist countries, in the United States today, in England in the 1920s, at any time, in any place. There always are many people among the masses in the imperialist countries who believe, who have been taught and believe the lesson that imperialism serves their interests, that they are sort of partners along with the imperialists in exploiting those in the third world, those in the imperialized and colonized world. In fact, the opposite is the case. The whatever investment goes to build industry and to develop the colonial world is taken away from the workers of the imperialist world, so that imperialism impoverishes those at home, and we will talk more about that in the future. And this means that imperialism is basically a continuation of capitalism by somewhat different means, a continuation of capitalism on an international level. It involves the same mechanisms of exploitation, enrichment of a few by the impoverishment of the many, that is the fundamental motivating force in capitalism. Finally, the role of the communist movement. When I went to school in the 50s, and then later finishing high school and going to college in the 60s, it was the height of the Cold War. Communists were demonized. Communists never did anything good. This was a position that was simply never questioned. Actually, the people who did question it, quite often lost their jobs and so forth in the United States in the Cold War era. So the position that, or any of the positions that we now recognize as part of this anti-imperialist framework, these were outlawed virtually. They were demonized, they were excluded, and you weren't permitted to have them. If you were a teacher and you tried to teach these things, you could lose your job. If you were a worker, you could get kicked out of your union. It was like the period of the witch craze, right? These were unorthodox ideas. You were not supposed to have unorthodox ideas. Once you understand the history of imperialism, you have to reevaluate the role of the communist movement. The communist movement of this century has not succeeded in building a truly communist egalitarian society. So by its own definitions, it has not been very successful. If you take as its goal communism, they haven't managed to build communism. On the other hand, it's been perhaps the most successful reform movement throughout the world in winning reforms, particularly in the area of labor rights, higher wages and better working conditions and so forth, looking for the union movement. And internationally, it's been the leading force in defeating colonialism and imperialism. It played a tremendously important organizing role in much of the world, and led anti imperialist national liberation forces in many places, so that once you recognize the role of imperialism and its exploitative motives, and you consider the anti-imperialist framework, you have to re-evaluate the communist movement. The communist movement doesn't become perfect, but it has to be seen as a response to imperialism, exploitation, capitalism, and so forth. So please consider these things and read the study of this webpage, and we'll talk about it more in class. Thank you.